Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and every week, every Friday, I am honored to share the microphone with truly interesting people. These are people who are entrepreneurs, authors, speakers, small business owners, virtual assistants, web developers, and frankly, anyone who has a wonderful story to share. And these are people who are excited to freely share their business wisdom, as well as tips and actionable advice with the audience. In short, they are willing to help us shorten our learning curve as we navigate the know, like, and trust economy. And today I welcome Doug Kizgan to the show, and his new book, Rethink Happy, highlights why the principles of virtue, sacrifice, and prayer are truly the driving forces for those seeking a joyful and productive life. Now, Doug is a serial entrepreneur, an organizational consultant, and the published author of what I just mentioned, Rethink Happy, which I happen to have on my desk. This book calls upon ancient wisdom, philosophy, religion, and modern psychology and shows how one can make changes in his or her life that greatly alter their path. He is also a licensee for a unique program called Culture Index. His company, Kizgan Group, there's a link in the show notes, by the way, works with entrepreneurs and executives to help them get what they want through the use of a short survey that validly measures 7 work-related traits. I'm going to have to take that survey. His former company, Daydream Senior Care, doing business as Home Instead Senior Care, was a 2-time Inc. 5000 fastest-growing company when he sold it. He formed his first corporation right out of college in 1991. And since then, he has built several businesses while also remaining an accomplished musician, songwriter, and actor. Doug is happily married and raising 5 children in San Antonio, and he offers guidance on how men can be better husbands and fathers. He says, and I quote, "Men should forget yourself. Put your wants and needs second to theirs. Continue to develop your relationship with your family based on finding out more about their desires while keeping yours in check." We're definitely going to have to talk about that. Doug, welcome to the podcast, and I am so glad that you're here. I'm loving your book. I mean, I just got it the other day. It's a great book.
Well, I'm glad you're enjoying it, Denise, and I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, your publishing house sent it to me, and I thought that was very kind of them. So I will be sending them a thank you note, and you as well. Listen, is there anything that I missed in the intro? Can you tell the audience a bit more about yourself that I may have missed that is very important to this conversation we're about to have?
I think you already said too much. I'm just kidding. I mean, that was quite
nice
an introduction. That was quite a detailed introduction, and I'm starting to think, gosh, they're going to really have high expectations almost. That kind of sounds like that guy knows what he's talking about, but I'm just like everybody else. It's still funny. That's the gist of my journey. I've had a very blessed life, and the most important thing, of course, is being married for well over 20 years and 5 children. That's the most important thing, but that wasn't always the most important thing to me. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
And I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, what I just mentioned about you saying kind of, put yourself aside, I find that fascinating because truly many people don't, men or women. We're busy people. We all have our excuses. I mean, I think we're born, this is just my observation of life, but I think we're born selfish. And I don't think it really kind of, winkles out of us until we make it a priority to go, it really isn't about me all the time. Am I wrong or right? Is that kind of where you're going with that?
That's exactly where I'm going, and that's exactly where I was. I mean, in fact, it was not until I had experienced a pretty strong failure that I finally got the message that it isn't all about me. I started a company, moved my family. At that time, we had four kids who were living in an apartment and moved them to a city where we didn't know anyone to start this business. And I thought, gosh, this is going to be so easy because everything else has been kind of easy for me up until then. And turns out it wasn't so easy. I didn't do my due diligence to understand the financial situation. I didn't know what the reputation of the company was within the city. I didn't do my due diligence in terms of salaries and current employees. It was an existing business that wasn't doing very well. But I thought that it would be pretty easy to turn it around, and I couldn't be further from the truth. I proceeded to take our family more and more into debt as we were trying to figure out how to get this company turned around. And it's about, 9 months into it, I'd halved my salary twice, and we were about $350,000 in debt when I sort of got the hit over the head that, you know, buddy, it isn't about you. It isn't about your ego. It isn't about achieving. It's about prioritizing. And what's really most important is that you maintain your relationship with your wife and with your kids, and that, and you look at this as, you know, what, how can I learn something from this, and how can I, you know, really focus on what's most important? And it's interesting. As soon as I focused on what was most important, some of the things that I needed to have in terms of people coming and help coming came, and the business turned around, and away we went. But it took kind of that low point to shake me out of my own ego to figure out that there was more important things than just achieving in business.
You said something real important there, because I have noticed this multiple times in my life, and I continue to notice it and welcome it. But once you identify that, you know, the universe really does not circle around you, and you kind of ask for help, whether you're physically asking for help or you're just mentally sending out, you know, prayer requests or whatever it is that you're doing, miraculously that help always shows up without failure, always. But you have to ask for it, and you have to be willing to receive it. And I have to tell you, receiving has always been a big problem for me. I'm kind of a, you know, I can do this. I'm a big girl. I got this. And that's always been a problem. And I'm still working on it.
Me too. Me too.
I'm so
finally
glad
learned.
I'm not alone.
No, not in the least. I tell you, I still struggle with it, but I'll give you an example of how I mean, ultimately it's swallowing your pride and being humble and being, and it's a dose of humility that you have to, well, you don't have to, but ideally if you're going to continue to grow, and especially if you're going to overcome or to get where you want to go faster, the faster you can find a mentor, the faster you can find a coach, whether it's a spiritual, you know, director, or whether it's a coach in business, the faster you're going to go. And when I started writing this book, one of the things I thought of is, okay, I got to go find somebody who's done what it is I'm doing and see if I can't figure out sort of a shortcut by working with them. So I found Dan Miller, who wrote 48 Days to the Work You Love. And have you heard of him or know him?
Oh, God, okay. Yeah. A lot of the people that I interview have been in his programs. I mean, you guys are a very interesting bunch. I have not been in his program, but I have a ton of his books.
He's a super guy. And anyway, I just kind of wrote him randomly. I didn't know him from anybody else. And he responded and started a conversation. And pretty soon I started working with him. And he introduced me to the publisher that published my book. And I ended up in his mastermind. So there's a number of things that just started taking off from just that initial, in a sense, humility to say, all right, I really don't know what it means to, you know, I don't know how to create a book and get it to market and get it published. And so kind of swallowed my pride a little bit and, you know, thinking I could do anything. And it worked out very, very, very well.
It does, doesn't it? Because I'm one of these people that I can do a lot of things. I'm, you know, one of these people, I'm very techie minded. And I love to build websites. I love technology. I'm a nerd in stilettos. I have a computer science degree. I'm a girl, but I'm a nerd. I just admit it. I have an invisible pocket protector. It's hard for me to ask for help. I do. It's hard for me to ask for help because I can do it on my own. I mean, and I'm also, I own a virtual assistant company, and I have to tell you, it took the longest kind of time for me to build a team, because seriously, anything I asked my team to do, I can do as well. And it finally figured, I figured out that I was killing myself doing, you know, mundane work when I should be doing the creative work. And I had to have some serious talks with myself. I really did. So there's a big ego thing going on there. I mean, I got myself in the corner and smacked myself around more than once.
But here's the beauty of it,
isn't
Denise.
Sad?
And
it's sad.
No. This is, you know, ever since I sold, about a year before, year and a half before I sold the company, I started consulting and using that program, as you mentioned at the introduction, with Culture Index, and it measures 7 work-related traits, and I've worked with dozens and dozens of CEOs and entrepreneurs, all sizes of business, all over the country. And something I found that's very, very typical is that trait. And that trait is your tenacity. That trait is your competitiveness. That trait is nobody does it as good as I do because nobody does it as good as you do. So then,
well, they don't.
That's what gets
I still
it started.
Fight with
that's,
that.
Yeah, but that's what gets these things going. And without that start, without that tenacity, nothing would get started. I mean, the company with the virtual assistants wouldn't get started. But then there's this phase or this natural progression that at some point you figure out there's only so far one person can go, you know, and there's only so far 8 people can go, and there's only so far 80 people can go. And so there's these natural transitions that occur at certain periods in companies' lives where we have to be realistic with who we are, what our talents are, what we bring to the table, and be honest about how big we can grow a certain thing or a certain department, and find the people who, if we're at our limit, find the people who can take it to the next level, if that's the case. When we sold our company, I fully believed the people who bought it could take it further than I did. Or else I wouldn't have sold it. So I felt almost obligated to sell. Now, I had had 2 other offers over the past, 5 years prior to that, and went a long way down the path to selling, and just it didn't feel right, didn't seem right, didn't think that they could come in and really take it, take care of our employees and take it to the next level. But this couple who ended up buying it, they were super sharp, really committed, had the heart in the business, the passion in the business, and had the skill and experience to do better, I thought, than we could, and they have. So anyway.
So it sounds like when you got ready to sell the company, you did your due diligence, which you had not done to start with, so lesson learned there. But it sounds like you also trusted your gut and your intuition.
Correct. Now, my gut and intuition are fed from data ever since my poor data experience buying that one. So I definitely try to get as much numbers, you know, in this case, meetings with these individuals. I also used the instrument that I use now, and I had them take the survey, so I knew what their traits were, what their strengths were before they bought the business. So I had an idea of what kind of leaders they would be after they took over, which I didn't have in the prior suitors, if you will, for buyers, potential buyers of the company. So I had more data that I felt more comfortable with. But yeah, ultimately, you get this sense of, you know, either foreboding, or you get this sense of, gosh, this seems to be meant to be. There's too many things coming together in alignment to make it not be the right thing to do.
Well, you said something really important, and that's data. And I think a lot of people don't stop to make the distinction that our instincts or our gut feelings or, you know, that little idea that just dropped into your head, those are all based on data. Your subconscious has the data. It's just feeding it back to you.
Yep. And some of us have a better sense of that than others. There's actually a trait out of the 7 that indicates someone has a little bit better gut sense. And so some of us are a little bit more talented, if you will, at getting reading cues, understanding body language, getting a sense for certain things. I can give you an example. My wife and I were family teachers at Boys Town, and we lived with 8 at-risk boys for a couple years when we were starting our family. And my wife has this trait of this sense of I don't know, just kind of a, it's not like a sixth sense or something like that necessarily, but just a sense for reading people, understanding things in a gut level. We had one young man who was struggling with smoking, and he and all the boys would come home after school, and we'd kind of greet him at the door, and I was standing at the door, and he came up to me, and I said, hey, maybe I shouldn't say his name. I'll say a fake name, Paul. He said, Paul, how was your day at school? It was awesome, awesome. He took two steps behind me, and my wife goes, you were just smoking, weren't you? And I can usually smell it. I can have a little bit of a sense for things, but and I turned around. And I probably had the same shock face he did. And she's like, "I know you're smoking." And he's like, "No, I wasn't." He said, "I know you were smoking." My wife said, and he said, and she goes, "Go get the cigarette butt." And he put his head down. He went outside and he went and got the cigarette butt. He walked right by me. I had no idea. My wife looked at him, and I don't know what she saw, but boom, she knew he was. I don't know. Anyway, can't explain it, but that's kind of the thing that some people have and some people don't.
You probably saw a micro expression of guilt or shame.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right.
A lot of people don't pay enough attention to those. I think they're very, very important.
Yes, I would agree, and I clearly don't do a very good job of that myself.
Oh, no, you probably do a better job than you think you do if you're – you know, making gut decisions. And I know that sounds a little bit, people like, oh, that's a little woo-woo. It's really not. I mean, think about all the times people say, you know, I didn't get on that plane and it's a good thing. Or I decided to take a different route in my car and I avoided a pile up on the, you know, I-90. I mean, your gut is a good thing to pay attention to if it's not trying to lead you astray. And you have to figure that one out too.
That's right.
Okay, so let's talk about how did you come to write this book? I mean, you know, when I was doing my research on you, I thought, man, this is a very busy man. He's leading a very, it looks like a very rich and full and rewarding life. How in the heck did you have time? I need to know. I mean, I really need to know how to do this.
Well, the first part is that I just had to write it. It was one of those things I felt compelled to write. I didn't see anything out there that was in this genre that talked sincerely about happiness in relative terms, including psychology, philosophy, and theology together in a way that wasn't like shove it down your throat kind of thing, but in a more open and just make you think way. So that was the first part. So then it took me a couple of years. I honestly just kind of dinked around with it, and I wrote a little bit, and I thought, oh, this is kind of neat, and I wrote a little bit more. And then all of a sudden I got this bug, and one of the reasons for it is my executive administrator is an author, and she's really, really sharp in terms of writing and editing. And I thought, okay, she's here, I've got the time, and I was traveling quite a bit for work, and so I thought, well, I'm on a plane, I'm in a hotel room, I'm not going to go out and do whatever when you know my family's not here, I've got the time. So that's when I wrote most of the book, on an airplane and in hotel rooms over the course of about that, let's see, it was probably the last nine months to a year. And it's a fable. So there's dialogue and there's characters, and it's fictional in a sense. And my dialogue, honestly, was not that great. It was okay. I think the story was pretty good, but the dialogue was not that great. And I gave it to my executive administrator, and over the course of about maybe 3 months, she held on to it, and she just made it shine. As far as dialogue-wise, just did an amazing job. And then got another editor to polish up sort of the fine details, and got the publisher and all that stuff, and away we went.
I'm guessing, just listening to you, I'm guessing that because she knows you and works with you, she was able to speak in your voice.
That's a great call. Yeah, so I had already worked, let's see, she's been with me for more than 3 years now, and it was probably 2 years ago. Yeah, she was probably with me a good year to a year and a half or so when I brought the project to her attention and she started working on it, somewhere in that range. But you're right. She knew, yes, she did know me. She understood, you know, my principles and values and things of that nature, and shared them from the beginning, because I think that's critical to any hire that you make, of course, that they share your, you know, your mission, vision, values, and all that good stuff.
Oh, absolutely. So when you handed her this book, did she go, oh, yeah, I mean, this is great, or what are you thinking? I'm already overworked. How did that work out? Because I can just see it. So many people, especially in today's culture where people do the bare minimum. You see it, I see it. Yeah, I'm guessing because you do, you know, share the same values that she said, let me see what I can do with it. But I could be wrong. So I would love to hear that story.
That's a great question, and one I don't think I objectively show enough appreciation for. She was ecstatic. She was very excited. She thought it was a great idea and it's a really cool story, and she thought she could really add something to it. And all of the, you know, the latter was certainly true. She, like I said, she polished it and made it really shine. And that's something that's in her wheelhouse and she loves to do, is to edit anyway. So to have this as sort of a side project with everything else we had going was really exciting to her.
See, that's a great story. Yeah, and yeah, even though she's in the workforce, she's probably on a salary. She was willing to take on this project, I'm guessing, because she believed in it. She believed in you. It upped her skill levels in different areas. I mean, there's so many reasons to say yes rather than say, what the heck are you thinking, dude? I mean, you could have gone either way, I'm thinking.
Oh, you're right. You're absolutely right. And that's why I said at the onset, I probably don't show enough appreciation to her for her mentality around it, because it easily could have been, are you crazy? This is a fictional thing with sort of non-fictional things in it. But no, she just embraced it and said, okay, boss, you know, kind of thing, attitude, and went forward. And if you will, indulge me in the acknowledgments. I want to share what,
yes,
I wrote. I put, a very special thank you goes to Adrian Lewis, who's my executive admin, for making this manuscript truly shine. I would like to think the ideas were solid and some of the storylines were interesting, but the flow of the book and especially the dialogue left much to be desired before I handed it over to her. Adrian added her pixie dust and made my Pinocchio book a real book, and so to her I am especially grateful. And now if I ever take full credit, you will know why my nose grew.
Now she has to listen to this. So, well, thank you for letting me do that. Oh, absolutely. It's important. It is important. Gratitude is something, it's a spiritual practice that I engage in every day. And I didn't always. I didn't, you know, my pigheadedness, if you will, got in the way. I was like, well, of course I'm grateful. I got to go now. I'm busy. But now I wanted to talk with you about this because I think that once people decide that they're going to develop some, you know, spiritual or mental practices around just the simple act of gratitude, that life changes. And what you did with her right now, that was big gratitude, and I really appreciate you doing that.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity, and you're absolutely right. Gratitude is tremendous. It's almost impossible to be grateful and sad at the same time. In fact, I would say it is. So, and in fact, two of the most likely reasons for sadness or to be sad, I mean, there are legitimate, totally legitimate reasons, of course, but in terms of beyond legitimate would be, number one, we either have let our relationship with the higher power, with God, go, or we are focusing so much on ourselves. And when we focus on ourselves, I mean, we're not really looking at gratitude. We're looking at potentially self-indulgence. And when we do that, that even typically drives us further down, because we're always looking for something to beat that, you know, make it, you know, more fun, or another big happy little pleasure thing or something like that, and never stopping to say, my goodness gracious, I have it so good. I am so thankful for this day, or thankful for my spouse, or thankful for et cetera. And that just takes us to a whole nother level of appreciation and typically joy.
You're right. And, you know, it can be a gratitude practice when you first wake up. It can be done multiple times during the day and just before you go to bed. I have found, because I'm kind of a cranky person. Doesn't sound like it, but I'm a cranky person. I can be, let's put it that way. And I have found that it is really difficult to throw a stumpy feet, or a high chair, you know, what do you call it, high chair fit. If I'm going, you know what, that air on my legs really feels good. I'm grateful for that. You know, if I'm outside or I'm watching the leaves waft down from the trees and going, oh, autumn is coming. You know, you can't walk around stumpy feeting all over the place. if you're breathing and saying, that's kind of cool, can you? I mean, you just can't. The two cannot exist in the same space.
Yep, exactly.
And you'd think it'd be a simple thing, but it's not. You have to actually kind of, you know, work it into your programming, so to speak. And once it's there, it's automatic almost. But look, as so many of us, and I'm, you know, my hand is in the air, just go through life going, hey, it's all about me, darn it. What's wrong with you people? It's about me. Pay attention to me. That almost never works well.
It's not sustainable. That's for sure.
No.
But it's also, it's interesting though, when you say some of these things and sort of shaking yourself out of maybe patterns or habits or things of that nature, and the reality of it is, and why I wanted so much to have rethink in the title is that we're just not taking the time to think and analyze and take a step back or take a bird's eye view or go to the library and get somewhere where we're somewhere where it's completely quiet, no interruptions, turn off all electronic devices and literally be honest, super honest and candid with ourselves about where we're at and where we want to go. And, you know, what's the distance between and what are the activities that we need to insert in our life, like gratitude, showing gratitude, or alarms on our, like sticky notes on our, our walls or something that will shake us out and remind us to say, okay, take a deep breath and just be grateful, for example. But whatever, you know, there are a number of other things we can look at. But just taking that time to think and be honest with ourselves is so critical to experiencing more joy.
And listen, as I noted in my virtual green room, I'm a high-functioning workaholic. I love what I do. My office is in my home, so I work all the time. I mean, I really do. It is not unusual for me to be at my desk at 3:18 because I woke up and went, ooh, I have an idea, and race across the house and go to my desk and knock out some kind of idea. That is fun for me, but I have to say sometimes that also gets in the way because you get so busy. Your busyness is not really forward progress, is it?
Oh, that is so well said. Yeah, we talk about activity versus productivity. And
right.
So... Yeah, especially people who have this sort of sense of urgency, who like to keep moving or a little bit jittery, they'll take activity over thinking quite often, or activity ultimately over productivity. And so I'll ask someone, one of my clients or something, I'll go, how was your day? Oh, man, I got a lot done. And I said, okay, our three big rocks, how much closer, what activities today did you do to get yourself closer to your three big rocks for this quarter? I understand you're very busy, but what proactively, productively did you do to actually move the needle forward on the bigger things that you're trying to achieve right now? And that's a tough question, not only to get, but also to give. And it's kind of, it's usually eye-opening. And to be honest with you, Denise, I need to ask it of myself more often as I'm saying it, because yesterday was one of those days where I allowed myself to be taken. And the way one simple way I try to get myself out of that is the day before I organize the following day, and I use a calendar. I sometimes have enough little things, I just got to get them off and I put them on a to-do list, but that's pretty rare. Typically, I'm working on some big projects, and I just put them on my calendar. I put an hour there, and I literally do not let anything interrupt me during that hour. One of the influences to this...
I do the same thing.
You focus on
that and only that.
Yep.
Nothing else. You ignore the cat. It is.
Yep.
You don't answer the phone. You don't go, ooh, squirrel brain, I have to go do this. You acknowledge it, and then you go, I'll get back to it, and you stay on task. It's hard to do. I have a squirrel brain, I admit it. It's tough.
Same. Yeah, it is very difficult, but it's incredibly, releasing or peace-giving or something, because you can get so much more done in a shorter amount of time by setting those things aside without any interruptions.
And that's exactly right. You know what I started doing? I'm like you. You ought to see my calendar. It is gorgeous. I'm a list maker. I'm an inveterate list maker. My calendar is color-coded. It's just a work of art. But I finally decided, I don't always get everything done. And I don't know about you, but I beat myself up, and I'm working on that. I really am. But what I started doing recently that has been really, really helpful to me, and you said you have a to-do list, is I created a morning, afternoon, and evening personal practice for me. Not busy, not business, not work-related, not client-centric. Me. So I can get back to, you know, the things that I need to do for my health and spiritual awareness and, you know, my physical health, you know, get up and move around, taking 20 connected breaths. So I put this in Evernote, and I use their little checkbox thing. And mm-hmm. I'm telling you, what I do is I check through it. You know, I go out every morning. I have this gorgeous backyard, thank goodness, that I created myself, by the way. Everything in my backyard I did except the trees. They were there. But it's almost like a secret garden, and it's just a magical place for me. And I go out there, and I take my little iPad, and I check off 20 connected breaths or yoga or whatever it is that I have on my list to do every day, 32 ounces of water. And that's my morning routine. And then once I've checked it off, I can look at that and go, ah, oh, good girl. And I'm ready to go forward now and just really work. But I have to have that, I guess, that checklist. My brain just likes checklists. And once I can, you know, go click, 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 it's done, I feel better. There's just this kind of, whew, okay, now I can move forward. And I don't fall into that business trap. Does that make any sense?
Oh, it makes complete sense. I love it. Yeah. And so what you're doing is you're taking care, I mean, of yourself and in a sense sort of these, you know, these boulders, there's rocks, there's pebbles.
Right.
And you got to start with the boulders. You can't put as much in there until, you know, into the jar until you get the big things done first, the most important things that then drive everything else to be more productive, to be a better person, to be happier. And so I have actually the same thing. I have, I do mental prayer. I do exercise. So there's certain things I do in the morning, and then there's certain things I do in the afternoon, and those are the boulders, and those aren't getting moved. And nothing's going to get in the way. I mean, I should, you know, almost nothing will get in the way, I should say.
Right, right.
And I know when I miss it. And that's why, I love that concept, though. I think it's very, very, very effective.
Well, and it has been because it's so easy, you know. I mean, I'm a girl. We get distracted. And, you know, I'll be in the middle of building a website or two and then go, ooh, crawfish etouffee. Off to the kitchen I go. And I'm at the stove because I love to cook. And then it's like, ooh, squirrels. I go outside and, you know, I literally do chase squirrels with the dog. And then I'm back in here. And I found that is just not productive and I'll tell you why it's not productive. Because I beat myself up. It's not that I'm not getting stuff done. I am. But I'm also, you know, having this little boxing match in my head going, really, Denise? I mean, you messed up. Really? And, you know, having good Denise versus bad Denise and inner child, it's annoying and it's time-consuming. So I try to avoid that by, you know, doing all these practices, you know, morning, mid-afternoon, you know, my nutrition, that type of thing, and evening. So these are personal practices that if I let them go for one or two or three too many days, then I really beat myself up. So what I do with my Evernote list is I cross everything off, then the next day I duplicate it, redate it, and then uncross everything, making a mental note of what didn't get done the day before and choosing to be 1% better than that was the day before. And it's working. It's like magic.
I love the 1% concept. That is...
Yeah. Just a little bit
brilliant.
Better than you were yesterday. Right.
Because that's
you're
realistic.
Not putting this huge burden. Exactly, exactly.
And
but once
long
I started
term,
doing
it's huge.
That, yeah, it is. It's cumulative. So once I started putting me at the forefront of my health and my wisdom and my knowledge and nurturing all of the things that I have and nurturing friendships and nurturing, you know, I mean, just taking a good look at my dietary needs, you know, nutrition needs. Things like that get away from us, and then all of a sudden we don't feel so good, do we? So everything else starts failing around us.
Very true. No, I mean, if you're not taking care of your physical self and your spiritual self, we are ultimately made up of a body and soul, and they're both important to take time away. And in fact, it's just like anything else that you look at, whether you're looking at the Olympic athletes that just got done competing. I mean, if they are not consuming the right nutrients and the right ratios at the right times, they are not going to be as effective when they're running the race. And ultimately, entrepreneurs are like Olympic athletes. And there's times where we're just sprinting, and there's times where we're, planning and strategizing and coming up with our plan, and there's times when we're just executing on it. Anyway, there's different ebbs and flows, and all of them require ultimately to take care of ourselves, both mentally, physically, and spiritually.
See, that is brilliant. I had not thought of it in those terms before, but when you said that, I had this big old light bulb, the big Edison light bulb just went off over my head. That's brilliant.
Well,
I actually have this Edison light bulb with this giant
light bulb. Do you really?
I actually do. It's in a closet somewhere. I mean, the thing is huge.
That's cool.
Okay, so let's talk about guiding principles. You talk about this a lot in your book.
Mm-hmm.
So could you list those out, the ones that society right now really kind of takes and holds in high esteem, and what we probably should look at replacing them with?
Sure. So ultimately, if you look at society, you think fame or money or, good looks or something of that nature. And it's kind of a little bit of a joke in the book. But what's really cool, and one of the aha moments for me in my research, was when I had read a book by Dr. Martin Seligman, who's considered the father of positive psychology. And he did and his colleagues did an extensive research project and looked over the course of all civilizations of all time and determined that there were six foundational principles that all human societies espoused or had, and they were these: love, wisdom, temperance, courage, justice, and transcendence, or the concept of a higher power. So every single civilization, now of course you have some civilizations that didn't, live them out or didn't believe in them or something like that, but primarily these principles are the undercurrent of all people, and I believe they're written on our hearts, and you can look back through theological things or even philosophical, back to Aristotle, or look through Augustine or Thomas Aquinas, or if you look at virtues in general, you can throw in Ben Franklin, who had a really cool practice. He identified 13 important virtues, and he would gnaw at each one a week, so that once a quarter he would hit on one of those 13 virtues, and if you do a search for that, you will be able to find his 13 virtues and how he kind of laid that out. But anyway, so this concept of virtue or principles to live by is absolutely integral to us being happy, to being joyful, is to understand them, learn them, learn as much as we can about them, and live them out.
I'm watching millennials in particular, but I'm watching a lot of people just kind of wander around going, I don't really know what's going on in the world. It's kind of a mess right now. And I'm wondering, and I have been wondering, it's not just this conversation, but I am wondering how much of what is going on in the world has to do with, honestly, lack of education, or true education, self-education. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that is one of the most important questions that we should be asking ourselves as a society, and especially as parents. I believe that parents are the primary educators of their children, period. And it's so easy to get caught up into social media or the media or what have you, and not to think about what are our children being taught at school. And much of it is great. Much of it is good. But much of it leaves some to be desired. And there are many options.
Some
for
of it
kids,
is head scratching, let's be honest. Some of it you have to wonder what lunatic wandered in off the street and implemented that. Some of it is just god-awful.
Yeah, well, okay, so yes, The principle, well, I could give you a bunch of different examples, but
I
mean, the bottom line is, you know, we're losing these principles of love, wisdom, temperance. We're losing these principles of transcendence and teaching what justice really means, and fairness and humility, and all of these foundational virtues and principles are being sort of subjugated by some, you know, things that aren't really true. And it's very simple to find what is true by looking over the course of these, you know, experts who have done the research and done the due diligence to determine what these things are. And when you hear them, and if you're, you know, if you really take a deep breath, look at them, read them, think about them, you can't help but think there is a, you know, there's a huge amount of truth behind them. And you're right, in the educational system, we're missing the boat.
You know, one of my all-time favorite places in the world, always has been since I was a very young child, is a library, a good old-fashioned Dewey Decimal type library. And honestly, if you want to find out, you know, what has gone on in the past, what is history, go to a library and look at the old versions of what is being touted as history now. They're eye-openers, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a library was always one of my favorite places to go. I haven't done it as much recently, but I have taken my kids to the library since we've lived in San Antonio here, San Antonio, Texas, and I have taken them here. We have library cards. We had library cards in where we lived before, Kansas City. So, yeah, I mean, it's a shame. And the interesting, one of the most fascinating things, again, and I, as I've research, if you look back to Aristotle and Socrates and Plato, and you look back at what they've developed in terms of their understanding of how we think and how we exist, there really hasn't been anything that's better. There have been some little tweaks, but by and large, they had most of the sense of being or metaphysics figured out. Socrates said, and most people heard this, the unexamined life is not worth living. And so I think it begins
right.
with we've got to examine. But the cool thing is Aristotle came later and he said the unplanned life is not worth examining. And so, you know, if we don't have a plan, you know, where are we going to go? Where are we going to get to? And I see so many people
exactly.
who aren't writing down goals and putting them on the refrigerator or putting them on a whiteboard or putting them on a sticky note or sitting down with the family and saying, son, okay, you're a sophomore in high school. Where do you want to go to college? Okay, what do you have to do now? What activities right now? The fact that we just talked about this on the way to school today. I try to take the kids. When I'm in town, I take the kids to school in the morning. I just love that time. I do not allow them to be on a phone. I do not allow the radio to be on. We've got about a 15 to 20 minute drive, and some days it's painful. Nobody wants to talk, or one person's grumpy or something like that. But most of the time, we have some great conversations. And today, literally, we talked about goal setting. And so, you know, it's something that is missing. And again, we got to plan before we got to examine. Sure, examine is great. Take that bird's eye view. Now develop a plan of where we're going, you know, how we're going to get to where we want to go.
Oh, exactly. Listen, I don't know about you, but when I was a kid, the most commonly asked question by the adults that, you know, maybe grandma came from the other side of the state to visit, or, you know, a teacher, but the common thread in my childhood was, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well,
mm-hmm.
that, of course, had me very curious. I wanted to be, you know, I wanted to, you know, go to Egypt and dig in tombs. Now I realize that I hate sand, and that was never going to be an option. And when I was a kid, I was like, ooh, I'm going to dig up bones. It's going to be a lot of fun. Then I was going to be a nurse, and then I was going to be a veterinarian, and I grew up to be a nerd. But it asked questions. And who knew that was out there? I didn't know. But you know, it's just, it got me curious of what am I going to be when I grow up? You know, what can I do? What should I do? What do I want to do? And, of course, I want to do all kinds of things, and I still do. So that's the lasting legacy of those questions when I was a very young child. What do you want to be when you grow up? I don't intend to grow up, so it's kind of an open-ended question, but it's still fun to contemplate, you know.
Absolutely. I remember when I was a kid, and I would take out the trash, and I would just barely get that doggone trash to the curb, and these garbage guys would come by, and they would pick them up like it was tissue paper and throw them in, and I was like, you know what, someday I want to be like that. So my goal of who I wanted to be, I wanted to be a garbage guy. That was my, and coincidentally or ironically, I graduated with a degree in biology, and I got into recycling. I was a recycling coordinator for a company. That was my first job out of college, and I thought, hey, I'm a trash guy.
There you go.
I'm that garbage guy I wanted to be, obviously on a little bit different level, but
right.
concept, but kind of a funny thing. But those are so healthy for kids. It's so good for kids to start picturing and thinking about it and okay, well, I want to be that. Okay, great. What does it mean to be that? And I think it's incredibly important for parents to encourage that whatever comes out of the child's mouth is okay until they figure it out that it isn't. I'll share just one other story. The reason I have a degree in biology is because I said in high school at one point I wanted to be a doctor, and gosh, all my family just thought that was the most awesome thing you could possibly be and encouraged me, and I got into it, and it wasn't right, and it wasn't the right thing for me, but I stuck with it thinking, well, it must be the right thing because everybody told me it was the right thing. And so, you know, I don't have any regrets. I don't believe in regrets, but I look back and I think, gosh, what would have happened if I had, you know, pursued the theater degree that I almost received when I was doing it on the side, or what if I had learned a little bit more about business a little bit sooner, maybe I wouldn't have made some of the mistakes I made. And I think, you know, it's all part of the plan, and it's all, you know, we're here where we're at right now for a reason, and hopefully we've learned along the way the mistakes and things. But it just kind of makes me think that if it were just less encouraged, you know, it might have been a little bit different, maybe better path, maybe not, but something to think about.
But the thing is now, I mean, these days, look, when I was a kid growing up, you know, your parents or your grandparents had one job, it seemed like, one, that was it, and they stayed there forever and ever, amen. Yeah, and these days people, I mean, what I love about living in modern times as opposed to when my parents were growing up, I guess, oh, God, I hope my mom is not listening to this. She will cut me off her Christmas card list as big as you please. She's a mean little woman. But let me tell you, I mean, it used to be that you were just kind of, you took your path, whatever that path was going to be, whether, you know, it's encouraged by your parents or your family, or you grew up in a farming family, whatever it was. And now we can kind of do whatever we want to be. I've had multiple careers in my life, and I'm sure I'll have one or two more before I'm done. And I will have a ball doing all of them.
Exactly. I got asked to write an article, and I did a little bit of research for it. And current statistics estimate the average person will have 12 to 15 jobs in a lifetime now.
Really?
12 to 15.
And I'm acting like I'm surprised, but on further reflection, I'm really not.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's kind of mind-boggling the rate that has changed. You know, I mean, what, a couple of generations.
Just a couple few decades, yeah. It hasn't been long.
No, but I mean, when you think in terms of that, you're like, we don't even know. Well, it's just like you getting into what you're now a complete expert in. You couldn't even have fathomed what that was that you could be an expert in 5-10 years ago.
It didn't exist.
Exactly.
Mexico. Literally, it did not. The virtual assistance industry is a fairly new industry, and I'm telling you, it just kind of came out of nowhere. And now, of course, it's a huge growth industry, but there's no possible way I could have known. I had never heard of the term, didn't know what it was. Now I'm an expert.
Yep, and that's why, you know, I understand big, hairy, audacious goals, you know, the BHAGs, and I understand 10-year, 15, 20-year things. I think it's good to do exercises where, you know, you're giving a speech at your 80th birthday or things of that nature that stretch your mind a little bit. But ultimately, I think 3 years is really the sweet spot. I mean, a year, of course, you can do that too. But 5 years, of course, you can kind of do that. But 3 years is where there's a stretch, but there's also, you know, a strong likelihood that you're seeing something fairly accurately. So anyway, in terms of goal setting or thinking conceptually, I think 3 years is a great number.
Oh, I agree with you. I remember back in the day when I was still employable, you know, the question is, well, where do you see? Because trust me, I am unemployable now. You can't afford to hire me to work in your office. I run with scissors. I don't play well with others. You do not want me there. But, you know, the question was always, so where do you see yourself in 5 years? And I almost every single time would give myself an invisible concussion from rolling my eyes. Like, where do you think I'm going to be? Not here. I'm not a good employee. Can you tell?
That's awesome. Yeah, well, that's a good thing. I mean, you obviously figured it out, and away you went.
Oh, yeah, I had to.
Yeah.
Okay, really, I don't play well with others, it's true. So let's talk about, you talk a lot about joy and happiness and the differences between those, and that's a pretty important part of your book.
It is. So when I say, or in the book, I make the case for happiness being sort of the fleeting pleasures, you know, a great wine or a good movie or something of that nature, which are all good. I mean, there's nothing inherently wrong with any of those things, and they can bring us happiness. But joy, I argue, is this foundational sort of, you know, no matter what happens to me or to others or something, that it's unshakable, that it can't be broken down, that no matter what happens to me, I maintain this joy. And that's the element, that's what ultimately the elements of the book are trying to sustain or trying to impart, are what are these things that are really lasting in life, that are written on all our hearts, are written things that we can learn with our brains and things that we can get our wills to get behind, our self-control to get behind, in order to have this more sustainable joy throughout our lives.
So what I'm reading in the book is that joy really is a choice.
That's absolutely true. Largely, it is a choice. It's a fundamental concept that we decide that we better understand who we are as human persons, and we understand philosophically why we exist, how we exist, and we make the decision, the conscious decision, that to whether something good or something bad happens to us. I one of my mentors said, "There's no such thing as failure. There's winning and there's learning." Okay, so conceptually, it's still failure. Okay, we can objectively say this was a failure in certain terms. However, we don't intellectually have to accept that failure means that we are bad or that we screwed up or whatever. It happened for a reason, for us to learn something so that we can grow in virtue and do better the next time we have the chance. One analogy or one concept is, you know, how big or how heavy of a, how beautiful of a picture could you hang on a nail that when hammered into the wall had zero resistance going into the wall? I mean, if you put it in just the drywall, you can't hang a beautiful, big, beautiful picture on there. But if you go through a stud and it's hard to pound that in, or, you know, now it can really be foundational, really be strong, and really hang on to something. And that's the way with our lives too. If everything was given to us and everything was perfect and everything was happy, 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 it's almost impossible to build enough virtue to weather a storm, because at some point it's going to come. And if you have an unsustainable joy, you know, if you don't have that, you're going to get shaken pretty hard, which is essentially what happened to me, which is essentially why I wrote the book.
And that makes sense. Like, happiness to me, and I've noticed this, happiness is fleeting. Like, I just recently acquired two tiny ginger kittens. I had lost two of my long-term companion ginger cats. One was 18, almost broke my heart, and the other one I just lost in July. He was only 10 years old, but he had late stage heart disease. So, you know, here comes, yeah, I had no intentions of replacing them. It was way too soon. Went to the post office. Who does this, Doug? Went to the post office, see this couple holding tiny kittens in their arms, and of course, something propelled me across the parking lot, and long story short, I replenished my ginger kitten stock. I have two. I brought home two. But I want you to know, I showed great restraint. They had three. I only brought home two. But I was so proud
of
myself.
Good for you.
I know. And as it turned out, Henderson's pet carrier was still in the car because I brought him home in a cardboard coffin, and it was just one of those serendipity things. But, you know, one of them just brushed up against me just now, and that made me happy. That made me smile. That's not joy, though. Joy is a more profound, more self-sustaining thing. It's, as you said, a foundation. Happiness to me is fleeting. Me and my little kitten came over and kind of licked my leg and said, "Hi, Mom," and wandered off. That was happiness. But he's gone now. He's over there. I'm looking at him. So I think, you know, how to differentiate between the two is really important in determining how you're going to live your life. Or am I wrong? Does that make sense?
No. You're spot on. And again, it's a beautiful thing that you have these cats, these animals that love you and that show their affection in special ways, and those are special events. Downplay
it. It's an event. I love that.
But it's
that was perfect.
Exactly.
Right.
So then how now, though? Okay, now they're gone. So then does that mean I'm sad? No, it can't mean that now that I'm not getting that, I'm sad. So how is it, what is it that keeps that sort of foundational joy, regardless of whether the little happinesses come in and out? And that can only be done by, two things, thinking of others, thinking of other people before ourselves, and then having a relationship with God, some relationship with the higher power, some form of meditation or prayer. And we know, and this is the cool thing, when you talk about God or you talk about prayer or things of that nature, some people get a little bit upset, but there are tons of scientific evidence that prove that mentally focus-oriented, heart health, breathing, everything that has to do with our mental processes and our physical self can be improved by a regular, habitual practice of prayer and meditation. And one of the more recent studies, and you can probably search and find that they did 27 minutes a day for, I think it was 8 weeks of meditation, and they measured their brains with MRIs, and literally their brain makeup in the area of focus and calming changed, physically changed, simply from this daily ritual practice, 27 minutes a day of meditation. So, and the science is just not as promulgated as it should be, because it's so important to sustainable joy.
It really is, and I'll be honest with you, I think that anybody that doesn't, and this is just my personal opinion, I'm not espousing any religion or anything else, but it is just my observation of life that it's pretty arrogant to think that we're here alone, that we just got plopped down on this marble and said, go for it, that nobody is here helping us or guiding us. I just think that's pretty arrogant, but that's just my observation.
I couldn't agree more. So.
And I wanted, we've only got 2 more minutes. I told you this would go fast. I'm telling you, one of the things that you just said that is so important is the power of meditative prayer. And I have tried to meditate for years and years and years. I think I've mentioned I have a squirrel brain or monkey brain. And I have this kind of a bad habit with meditation. I either fall over and drool, or I start making my Thanksgiving grocery list. It can be July. It doesn't matter. I'm putting a turkey on the list. That's how my brain works. But I have found that if I start doing, and I found a chair yoga that allows me to do meditation while doing these movements, and I do them outside on my porch, and I'm telling you, I can tell instantly that I feel better, my breathing is better, I'm calmer, I'm now able to go, okay, I can face the day now. So, you know, yoga with the ums and the ahs, and I guess traditional yoga does not work for me. Finally, hold on something that does work, and I'm so happy. You have no idea. I don't have to drool. I don't care about the turkey. I'm good.
Well, I think the other thing that for some of us, we feel guilty that we're, not doing anything. It seems like, quote unquote, we're not doing anything, when in actuality we're doing one of the most important things we can do for ourselves and for those around us is to take that time. It helps you focus. It helps you be more productive. It helps you be more emotionally stable. All of these are scientific. All of these are research-based. All the statements I just made are absolutely foundational in research. So give that time to yourself, and it'll pay huge dividends.
And the thing, and I don't know about you, and this may be a female thing more often than not, but women tend to get guilty if they do anything, you know, that even approaches what I call healthy selfishness. We've got to take care of ourselves. We have to. Even if we live alone, we still have to take excellent care of ourselves. I mean, it's our foundation. You've used that word a lot, and I love it. We have to have that foundation, or we get through the day and we wake up the next day and go, what happened? What happened? Did I get anything done? Did I forward? So, I mean, I love the book. Listen, we are 10 seconds. We'll still record, but we'll lose people in the chat room. Where can people find you on the internet, and where can they find your book?
So the book is at any online retailer. My website is rethinkhappy.com. Surprise, surprise. And then kisgengroup.com on the organizational consulting side of things.
Excellent. Doug, do you have any parting thoughts? Do you have anything that we didn't cover that you think is important for people to know?
Oh, goodness. Denise, I've just enjoyed this conversation with you immensely. I think we've covered the most important foundational things. I think the big thing is to take a step back and really think and plan and hopefully take what we've talked about and implement it and make some action right now. Write down some action item you're going to do right now, today, differently based on what we talked about.
That is excellent advice. Doug, thank you so much for being with me here today. I have thoroughly enjoyed meeting you and reading the book and chatting with you, and you really cemented some ideas that, you know, I've had about bettering just myself. You know, you want to be the best version of you that you can be, right? And it's something
Absolutely.
That I've been working at and really putting these practices into place, and here you come. I mean, you know, this has just been perfect timing for all the things that I'm working on internally with myself, so thank you so much. And I know the audience enjoyed the takeaways as much as I did. And listen, everyone, the show will be available for download in about an hour. You can find us in iTunes. You can find us all over the place. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Doug Kisgen, K-I-S-G-E-N. And I will see you next week. Doug, thank you.
Thank you, Denise. I appreciate it very much.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on your Partner in Success Radio.